Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to Sci-Fi on Screen, and this week's episode we're going to be comparing Honda's original 1954 Godzilla film with Roland Emmerich's 1998 film and Gareth Edwards' 2014 Godzilla film. But before we get to Godzilla, I want to do a little housekeeping. When anyone, you know, sends feedback on various places, Reddit, the webpage, Facebook, I like to give a shout out to folks to let them know that I'm reading. First up this week, I want a big thank you to Boyd Godfrey, who's been listening for a while. Boyd, I want to say thanks for the Predator video, man. He threw up a link on the Predator webpage of Sci-Fi on Screen and to the Predator rap video, which is pretty hysterical. You can go to the Predator page on my website. You'll see it down there. Check it out. It's funny. You'll love it. Boyd, thanks again. So I want to go some feedback on Road Warrior. A little feedback since the last episode. A Reddit commenter named Nemo Thorks hipped me to the fact that Brian May, who did the soundtrack for the first two Mad Max films, is not the same Brian May that was in Queen. That was my mistake, and he hipped me to that. So I just wanted to do a little editorial correcting, as it were. He also threw up another comment that he was pretty happy that I had said that Max in the Road Warrior films was not really a hero, but more of a scavenger. I thought that was pretty cool. Then there's some feedback on my X-Men podcast. A guy on Reddit named Mr. Impossible said thank you for your podcast. So Mr. Impossible, thank you for the thank you. Another Reddit commenter, Mr. Maz, commented, quote, "The first X-Men is a totally underrated film in the comic book movie genre. It is so well structured. It handles introducing in media res, universe surprisingly well, and has a fun trade-off in terms of audience surrogacy," which I thought was a really cool thing. So if you listen to my X-Men podcast, Mr. Maz, you know that I totally agree with you, and I think it's an amazing film as well. So that's it for a little bit of housekeeping. Before I get into the Godzilla comparison, though, I do want to state that Godzilla is a very rabidly fan-protected franchise. I mean, there are Godzilla fans out there that are extremely attached to the Guy in the Suit Godzilla franchise. That is not me. I am not a Godzilla maniac. I love genre film, and I like talking about when I think genre film works well. So I've seen a lot of the Godzilla films, and they are of a type of B-movie that doesn't really float my boat. They're very goofy very often. They have their charms. And some of them are cool. Obviously, you know, the monster fights are cool. But I just want to put out there that if you're a Godzilla maniac and you're sharpening your knives, that I will be easy prey because I'm not a huge Godzilla canon fan. I couldn't quote you what's post this and what's post that and what's post Return of Godzilla and so on and so forth. I love film. I love genre film. So I'm really going to just talk about Honda's first Godzilla film and then the two American remakes. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there in case I offend any Godzilla fans out there. Not my intention. So we got three films to compare to each other. Let's get rolling before, you know, the end times arrive. So we're going to start with the backgrounds on the three films. We'll start with 1954 film directed by Ishiro Honda, simply titled Gojira. Some of the background on this is that the producers of this film had planned a completely different film than Gojira, but the project completely fell apart, and the company Toho that was backing it just demanded a film, any film, within like a short period of time. There's a producer by the name of Tomoyuki Tanaka, was on a plane, and he read about this, what's called the Lucky Dragon Incident. Basically, the Lucky Dragon Incident was about a real Japanese fishing ship, the Lucky Dragon 5, was overwhelmed when the U.S. Castle Bravo nuclear test had a yield of 15 megatons rather than the planned 6. There were military personnel and island natives and several Lucky Dragon 5 crew members believed to be in a zone of safety, thinking that it was only going to be a 6-megaton test, suffered severely from radiation sickness, and at least one person died 6 months later. So, obviously, for the Japanese, this created a widespread fear of this uncontrolled and unpredictable nuclear weapons, which the filmmakers obviously symbolized with Gojira. The actual event also played a major role in drawing attention to the hazards of fallout, and concerns were widely spread about radioactive contaminated fish, you know, the Japanese food supply, so on and so forth. The monster angle supposedly was derived from the success of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which came out in 1953. Ray Harryhausen's stop motion, you know, effects were like the big deal. And also King Kong, which was probably one of the first, you know, kaiju movies, that word, I believe. The kaiju genre. The filmmakers took inspiration from dinosaurs such as T-Rex, obviously, Iguanodon, Stegosaurus, big time, from the back, right? The scales on Godzilla. Really, in a sense, you can look at Godzilla and say he's a mashup between a T-Rex and a Steg. But it was more like an emergency, you know, because they needed to give Toho a film that all this kind of came together. So the name Gojira was also very difficult. They couldn't come up with a name originally. And it went through several names prior to getting Gojira. And because of that, the first draft of the film was called simply G, the letter G. And then Toho held a contest to name the monster. And then they eventually named it Gojira, which was a combination of the Japanese words gorilla, gorira, and whale, Gojira, Gojira together. So Godzilla is gorilla whale in English. Gojira, I should say. A false rumor about it was that a staff member of Toho inspired came up with Gojira because it was claimed to have been his nickname, which was not true and confirmed to be false by Ishiro Honda's widow, Kimi Honda, in an interview. A bit about director Ishiro Honda. His early film career, actually, he worked as an assistant under Akira Kurosawa for many years before he made Godzilla. And after Godzilla, he spent his years directing, I guess, a lot of Japanese sci-fi TV. And then I believe he did one or two more Godzilla films in his career. So that's background for the 54 film. Now, some background on Roland Emmerich's 1998, simply titled Godzilla. So in 1992, you know, many years after the original Godzilla and many sequels, TriStar acquired the rights to Godzilla from Toho, and they were going to produce a trilogy of Godzilla films. You know, their promise was they were going to remain very true to the original series, cautioning against nukes and runaway technology. Two screenwriters by the name of Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio were tapped to write the script, and they submitted a draft in late 1994. So earlier that year, Jan DeBont of Speed and Twister fame became attached to direct, and he started pre-production on what would have been a 1996 summer blockbuster film. DeBont's Godzilla would have discarded the atomic origin and replaced it with one wherein Godzilla is an artificial creation constructed by Atlanteans to defend humanity against a shape-shifting extraterrestrial monster called the Griffin. Thank God DeBont did not make Godzilla. Not that Emmerich is that much better, but that's wacko. So Stan Winston was brought on to do effects for the film. Stan Winston crafted sculptures of Godzilla in the vein of the classic design in the DeBont version, and then DeBont wound up leaving after TriStar refused to approve his like $120 million budget. Then, prior to the release of Independence Day, director Roland Emmerich and producer Dean Devlin signed on to do Godzilla under the condition they would be able to handle the film, quote, their way. They tossed the previous script in the Jan DeBont production. They provided a new one where the Godzilla character was largely rewritten. There's a guy by the name of Patrick Tatopoulos who came on board to design the new Godzilla, which would be completely CGI. And according to Tatopoulos, the only specific instructions Emmerich gave him was that the monster Godzilla should be able to run incredibly fast. Other than that, he was on his own. Originally, right, in the Honda film, he's a sort of erect standing reptilian sea monster, was reimagined by Tatopoulos as a lean, sort of a bipedal iguana-like creature that stood with its back and tail parallel to the ground. And this is all post-Jurassic Park, obviously. Spielberg was the first one to popularize what had been gaining ground in sort of dinosaur circles, where they were kind of reconceiving how these things must have acted and even looked. So obviously, you know, Emmerich, being a huge Spielberg, you know, devotee, as I will point out as this film goes, went with sort of, you know, the supersized T-Rex, as it were. At one point, they were going to do motion capture for Godzilla, but it ended up looking too much like a guy in a suit Godzilla, which Emmerich did not want to do. He wanted to do a CGI Godzilla. So Emmerich, before Godzilla, had done Moon 44, which is kind of a low-budget sci-fi film, Universal Soldier, which was kind of his little breakthrough, Stargate, and obviously Independence Day, which was his big hit. So that's the background for Emmerich's film. And now we have the 2014 film, again, simply titled Godzilla, directed by Gareth Edwards. So after the release of 2004's Godzilla Final Wars, which marked the 50th anniversary of Godzilla, Toho announced that it would not produce any films featuring Godzilla character for 10 years, so they kind of locked the door. In March 2010, it was confirmed by Toho that Legendary Films had acquired the rights to Godzilla. In 2011, they named British filmmaker Gareth Edwards director of the 2010 film Monsters, which was debut to direct Godzilla. I mean, not bad from a low-budget monster film to Godzilla in a very short period of time. Edwards made quite the leap. So in 2010, the first script was commissioned, and a guy named David Callahan, who scripted the films Doom and Horseman, was named to write it. He did research on Godzilla's history, animal documentaries, as well as natural disasters, and local government disaster planning. So he did all this great research in order to depict the events as close as possible to real-life disasters. So in July 2011, David S. Goyer was attached to do a rewrite. Goyer worked only on the script for a couple of weeks and did not get credit. Then in November 2011, a guy named Max Borenstein was hired to continue. In 2012, a guy named Drew Pierce did a polish. In 2013, Frank Darabont was hired for a rewrite. And in interviews, Darabont described his plans for Godzilla as returning to a terrifying force of nature. So who knows what ended up what? This is the classic Hollywood. Always lots of chefs in every batch. And briefly, Gareth Edwards, again, as I had mentioned earlier, he'd done a film in 2010 called Monsters, which was, you could tell, I mean, I watched the film Monsters and I don't like it very much. I think the human characters are so boring and so unwatchable that it's really a struggle to get through the film. But you can tell that the guy has an eye for this kind of stuff, like the way he shot his monsters and how much he used tension. They weren't on the screen all the time. Like something was going on. I definitely got the sense that this guy was going to do something. I knew that he would need, you know, a really good script because the script for Monsters is pretty bad. But there was definitely something about Monsters. If you're curious, it's worth a look. I could say you could fast forward through a lot of it, but visually already, you know, something's going on here where, you know, this guy's, he's got something. He's got something. And I feel like it really came to fruition in his Godzilla. Okay, so now I'm going to compare the first chunk of each of these films, and I'm calling this sort of the lead up to the first reveal. So, you know, I'm going to compare and talk about how each film starts and, you know, gets you going until the first time you see Godzilla. So we'll start with the 1954 film, which is in black and white, by the way. Opens with Gojira in Japanese character. You hear these great, there's no music. You just hear these booming sounds coming at intervals. And then you hear the Godzilla roar, which, in 1954, when you first got there yet, you know, what did you know? The incredible Godzilla roar and these incredible boom, these big drum sounds. It's a great opening, actually. You know, it opens like a really intense, maybe a war movie or a drama or something. Really terrific. Really just stark, brutal bit of an opening. And then you're right on to the opening scene. We see a Japanese ship get destroyed. And the way we see it is sort of like light is erupting from under the water. And then we get a shot sort of the burning ship. And then quickly, we're back to Tokyo, and we meet our two main characters, Hideto, who's a salvage ship captain, and Imiko, his girlfriend. He gets a phone call, you know, it's in trouble, and since he works kind of for the maritime agency in some capacity, you know, as a captain, he's got to head out, sort of, you know, due diligence. So they say he leaves, and she has to go to a show by herself. He gives her, like, these show tickets. So they send another ship out to this area near Oto Island, and it's also destroyed. Same fate. A rescue ship is also destroyed. Quickly, this is turning into a very intense thing. We see these shots of these survivors pressing into the headquarters, trying to find out what's wrong, and, you know, who survived, any names, and, you know, nothing is known. And so now we cut to this fishing village on Oto Island, and the villagers are down near the water looking for, I think, one or two of their own who are out fishing who haven't come back yet, and we see this broken boat come back. this character named Masagi is on it, and the only words that he can say is, he did this, a monster. He's brought back to the village. We find out, too, that there's no fish. It seems like there's an old man who mentions the legend of Gojira, a mysterious monster from the past. Then there's the ceremony performed on the island because they feel like this monster's coming back. What the old man says is this a monster that used to feed on humankind to survive, and that the village used to actually sacrifice young women to him in order to appease him. And now, you know, they don't do that anymore because they're, quote, civilized, right? What you're seeing is an exorcism ceremony to sort of exorcise the demon Gojira before he gets there. The next scene is a storm lashing this poor fishing village on this island. I think Masagi, the character, is inside one of these huts while this is happening. And you see it destroying huts. This huge, you know, storm surge comes in. It's very funny. It's interesting in that you're getting the storm and a lot of the damage from inside the hut. So all you see is kind of light flashing outside and you hear the wind. It made me think of the basement attack early on in Spielberg's War of the Worlds, you know, where it's more about what you're hearing that determines what's going on than seeing anything. And I feel like, you know, Honda probably didn't have a lot of money, but it's very clever. Like, and it's done pretty well because you're just getting the terror of the people in the hut. And the storm that's going on outside. Is Godzilla out there? Is he not? You hear sort of his roar, maybe not. So that the interior of the hut's kind of cool. When they cut outside, and there's a lot of really cheesy miniature effects. And I've seen some sci-fi done in the mid-50s, right? So I'm not comparing the 1950 Godzilla effects to now. I'm comparing it to other films that I've seen, like War of the Worlds was done in 53, and you know, Destination Moon and all that. This is just really bad. I mean, the effects just look like really cheesy. And there's a down helicopter. It basically looks like a kid's toy. You know, there's no, however they dealt with the scale, it really looks very cheesy. So then we cut to this government hearing of some kind, and we're introduced to Yamane, who's Emiko's father. He's a paleontologist, and he's talking about snowman footprints in the Himalayas and that the abyssal regions of the Earth possibly housing some kind of monsters, which is something that will be echoed in the 2014 film, which as well. The islanders are reporting all this stuff, so Hideto, Emiko, and the father all depart for the island. And as they leave, we see, you know, leaving in a boat, there's this mysterious man with a black eye patch watching them leave. And we find out later, this is a colleague of Yamane's named Dr. Serizawa. Part of what they discover is irradiated drinking wells in some areas of the island, but not another. Which they find interesting. And they find this depression, right, which is supposedly a footprint. But they're all you see is the main character, Yamane, step into the depression. But Honda doesn't, I feel like this is a perfect opportunity to, like, show us the footprint. But he doesn't, which is weird, I find, very strange. And they also find a trilobite, which, of course, is an extinct animal. Immediately, there's this warning bell. Someone in the village is ringing a bell. They run up this hill, and, you know, now we're in our first event, which I will get to later. So, brief summing up of the intro here. There's some nice tension with things mostly happening at night, the storm, you know, the legends of Gojira. But for some weird reason, I never really feel the emotional buildup to when I first see Godzilla. And I think that it's the editing, actually. If you watch the first 20 minutes or so of you know, Honda's Godzilla, it's edited so choppily for whatever reason. Like, things don't flow into other things. Like, I feel like I'm watching a weird kind of docudrama where, you know, there's a scene of this, there's a scene of that, there's a scene of this, but I don't feel a sweep forward of a story, you know? And it's not, I mean, I do in a very artificial way, but I don't feel drawn in. And again, it's not because it was done in the 50s, right? I feel like Honda and his team lacked, like, basic movie editing skills. It's really just edited very strangely, and things just don't flow into one another. I don't know where I am half the time. Like, when they're having discussions and everyone's clustered around, they don't tell you where they are. When they had the hearing, when Yamane's talking about the snowman, I don't know where they are then. So I feel a lot of dislocation, and so it doesn't really gel for me. Like, this first 20 minutes, I thought to myself, well, he's not a really good director, actually. His basic filmmaking skills are not that great. So I wasn't that blown away by it. I did love the very opening of it, which the Godzilla roar and the drums, I thought was incredible. Those drums come back in over time. But the weird thing about them is I never know whether it's actually Godzilla's footprints or it's just the soundtrack. Because sometimes you know, the people on the screen actually react to that sound. Sometimes they don't. So it's, again, and I feel that's a failing of the filmmaker. Like, I should know whether this is a soundtrack effect or whether these sounds are actually Godzilla's footfalls, and I don't. So, yeah. So that's what I thought of Honda's ramping up. So now I'm going to talk about the lead up to the reveal in Roland Emmerich's 1998 film, Godzilla. Over the credits, we're getting these shots of French Polynesia. We're getting shots of nuclear testing. We're looking at sort of animal footage of actual lizards walking and swimming, guys in hazmat suits. And it's all done in like hazy black and white style, like it's redacted or something, you know? And then we see, you know, detonation of mushroom clouds and a last shot on a set of eggs, obviously, you know, tying us all in. Then we cut to a large fishing vessel in the South Pacific, present day. It's a storm, plenty of rain. We see right away on sonar that there's this object closing. And then, you know, good tension, lots of action on the ship. We don't know whether it's the storm or something else. And then there's a breach below decks. And then we see this massive tail smash the bridge windows, and then we cut away. So that's our first sort of opening shot. Now we're in Chernobyl in Russia, or at Chernobyl, I should say. And we meet the character Nick Titopoulos, played by Matthew Broderick. And he's also in a rainstorm in a car, and he's at the Chernobyl site collecting samples. And he does a cool thing. He puts these metal rods in the ground, connects them to a battery, and when he turns it on, the ground sort of erupts. The electrical current, I guess, brings the worms to the surface. But kind of cool, actually. Then a helicopter arrives, and these American Special Forces say, you know, you've been reassigned, sir, because he had permits to go there to study worms. He's on his way to Tahiti. Briefly, you know, we know we're in a very slick Hollywood movie. You know, we see a lot of money up on the screen, professional soundtrack, like, so far so good, very well mounted. So then we cut to French Polynesia, and we meet the mysterious French special agent named Roche, played by Jean Reno. He visits an old man who was on the freighter we saw get destroyed in the opening, and the guy's like in shock. Roche lights a lighter and puts it near his eyes, and we only hear the guy utter one word, Gojira! Gojira! So a little bit of a tag there. Then we jump to Panama. Titopoulos is meeting with military advisors. We see all kinds of army, you know, people there, and a Geiger counter is being pulled, lots of helicopters. And we hear Titopoulos talk about his Chernobyl research and about how the radiation enlarged the earthworms significantly there. So we're getting a brief tease, right, of sort of what will happen with Godzilla. Now, Emmerich gets right what Honda missed in the first film, because the main guy, the main military dude, leads Titopoulos to a depression. And Titopoulos is like, well, what do you want me to research? And he goes, you're standing in it. And then the camera, at that point, is horizontal. It tips up and goes straight up in the air. And you see that Titopoulos is standing in a giant footprint. And I don't know why Honda didn't do that. I feel like that was like, that's low-hanging fruit, man. That's a classic cinema thing. I mean, why he didn't think to do that is beyond me. But Emmerich recognized correctly that, like, oh, this is a no-brainer. This is a great shot. And it's a great shot. Then he meets part of a team that's also studying this. A woman named Dr. Elsie Chapman, plays by News Radio's Vicki Lewis, who I love. And now we have, you know, camera shot on a helicopter, and we see the procession of massive footprints leading away towards the sea. So now we cut briefly to New York City, and we meet Audrey Timmons, a very young, hot, as the camera will show very closely, aspiring newswoman played by a woman named Maria Patillo, who unfortunately is woefully miscast in this film, although I don't know what anyone would have done with that role. We quickly see she works for a real sleazebag anchor named Charles Kamen, played by Harry Shearer, Saturday Night Live, and Spinal Tap fame. Won't give her a shot unless she sleeps with him. We cut to Jamaica, and we get a terrific shot. We're sort of following jeeps and helicopters, and then the camera swings up and shows us sort of where they're going. And there's this massive ship in the distance, and we see these two massive claw marks that have torn right through the metal. The scale of it is great. The soundtrack, he was great. And Emmerich was right on track here. Like, he was, you know, he started well, and there are things about it in this movie that work, although I think, you know, as a full-on film, it's... So we get really close to one claw mark, and we see Titopoulos take a sample, and then we see Roche briefly looking at Titopoulos, you know, thinking, like, who is this guy? So now we cut to the eastern seaboard of the U.S., and we see these three fishing trawlers are suddenly moving backwards. So they've got their nets caught on something, so they think more rain. It's always been rain. Wherever the monsters appear, there's been rain so far, and that will continue. And I feel like Emmerich knew what Edwards knows, that you give the monster cover cinematically with the rain, and especially if it's purely CGI. You know, you don't want a pure CGI character out there where it can be, you know, where all the flaws will be evident. You know, you want to move it in and out of the screen so you're getting presence and a bit of clarity, but you don't want the viewers like us, if you're listening to this podcast, who are fairly critically minded, to start picking it apart. All of the Trollers are completely dragged under. We don't know what the force is. Of course, we do know what the force is. Then one ship pops up and then sinks. The clever thing here, you know, all the attacks up until now were on fishing vessels, right? So at the very least, it's consistent in that this monster is attacking vessels for food. You know, the initial vessel was a fishing vessel, and all of the vessels that we've seen them investigating were fishing vessels. And this also, you know, it was attacking the nets of the other three fishing vessels. So, you know, at least it's consistent. I mean, the fact that it's traveling to New York is ridiculous, but, you know, the monster's hungry, so it wants food. Now we cut to a military transport, and Totopoulos and the crew, they get the report about the trawlers, and now they're speculating. And they're talking about the French nuclear tests, Polynesian area, I guess, where the French did their tests, and that what they may be seeing is a muted aberration of a brand new species, a hybrid, caused by the radiation. So that's kind of the origin for this guy. And then a brief cut back to New York, and Audrey sees Nick on TV, and we realize that they used to be lovers, so that's their connection. Up till now, and this is the end of the lead-up, because the next scene, actually, Godzilla will appear, but Emmerich did a very solid job opening the film, except for the casting of Audrey, which was terrible, and her character, frankly. And the idea that a monster would swim from French Polynesia to New York City, I mean, what did he go through, the Panama Canal, you know? It's ridiculous. He's teasing us with the claw marks, the footprints, the nuclear fallout, the ships. I mean, it's great. The only difference here than the original film is the tone is very light, and this is in contrast to both Honda's original film and Edwards's 2014 film. This film is very light. You know, Matthew Broderick, Vicki Lewis, like, these are not actors. This is Emmerich sort of maturing into his sort of Day After Tomorrow tone, you know, where he has this absurdist style, right? This jokey, unrealistic human plot, idiotic characters, dumb situations versus the most devastating and intense colossal destruction you ever saw. The balance only worked once. He wasn't doing that with Stargate. He did it with ID4, Independence Day, and it worked. To me, Independence Day, which I will cover in a future podcast, it's a wonderful throwback film. It works. It's balanced well. But from then on, like, to me, he went way downhill. And this was the beginning of it. You know, this jokey, unrealistic, goofy pop culture thing. It's very transformery, too. I feel like Michael Bay, you know, took a page from Emmerich. Okay, so now let's do the lead-up to the 2014 film. So we get the opening credits, very similar to Emmerich's film. A lot of still black and white photography that's being redacted as we watch. We start with things like akin to mythological legends, then a shot of Darwin's sort of title page of Origin of Species. Then newspapers and redactions are meant to show us that a massive creature was destroyed by the nuclear tests in the 50s. So unlike Honda and Emmerich, who, you know, testing created, this was Godzilla existed, and the bombing, you know, all the testing was a cover for their attack on Godzilla and all the bombing that they did. So we do see cut into some of these old black and white films, or they created them new, you know, what will be mostly his ridged back when he's swimming in the water. So we see him right off the bat there, but not his head or anything, not a full shot. But the very last shot, just before the nuclear test hits, is him emerging from the water. So it's an incredible tease where you see the spikes rise up and he's just about to emerge from the water to be seen. And of course, we don't really see it. And then the bombs drop. And then we see something called the Monarch Project and we're out. And then we cut to Philippines in 1999. So we're still not in present day. And we see a helicopter flying with Project Monarch stenciled on the side. So there are two Project Monarch scientists, Ishiro Serizawa, which is a combination of Honda's first name and the character of Serizawa in the original film, which is interesting, and his colleague Vivian Graham. They're investigating this massive skeleton that they found. There was a strip mining going on, and they found this huge skeleton in a collapsed mine in the Philippines. What's amazing, the filming here is amazing. The shots of the jungle, beautiful wide-angle shots, and you know right away that you're in the hands of like a really solid director. We see the massive collapse from the surface, and then we're quickly underground with flashlights and suits. You know, they slowly light up what we see as this massive skeleton. It reminded me a little bit of like the alien egg area, a little Giger-ish, as it were. But it's actually a full-on skeleton, and the lights turn on in succession, so they reveal the skeleton little by little. It's very sharp, you know, as Edwards is so incredibly sharp in this remake. And then we hear dialogue, throwaway line, "Is it him?" Meaning the beast that they purportedly destroyed in the 50s. And Serizawa says, "No, it's much older." And there's radiation everywhere. And they discover two spores still there. One of the spores is hatched and one's still intact. And then we pan up from a huge hole in the whole area. And we see this from a wide establishing shot. There's this broken trail through the landscape that leads right to the sea. So we're getting the sense right away that something hatched, broke through, and disappeared. And at this point, you know, we only have Serizawa's brief, you know, all this information is being delivered very quickly. So, you know, if you're the casual filmmaker, we don't know whether it's Godzilla who escaped or what's going on. But if you're paying attention, you recognize that, you know, Serizawa's pretty sure that it's not him. It's something else. So mystery has begun. So now we cut to Zanjira, Japan. This is a nuclear facility, and we meet Joe Brody and his wife, Sandra, and their son. Joe is played by the ever-good Bryan Cranston and his wife by Juliette Binoche. We hear Brody talking on the phone. He's concerned about seismic activity near the reactor, and he's trying to get a meeting with his bosses. We get an Easter egg here of the frequency shape on a PC, which we will see later on in successive parts of the film. Looks like kind of a squat tower leaning in a little bit. You know, the son goes off on his own, takes the bus. Then this, what we're getting is that these seismic waves are not random like an earthquake, but a pattern. And of course, you know, Brody's very concerned because he feels like he's isolated this pattern and the plant, nuclear plant, might be in danger. They go to the plant. Sandra also works there. Joe sends her to the bowels of the plant to do an inspection. He goes somewhere else. And then whatever, the place starts taking a seismic hit and everything's shutting down. There's alarms going off. The area that his wife is in has to be quarantined because there's a coolant leak. So there's a very dramatic moment where there's sort of these emergency doors that they have to close, but Sandra and her team are not back yet. And Joe's standing there looking down the hall, seeing nothing, his hand over the button. The tension builds. He's hearing her via radio, and she tells him, "You got to close the doors. It's too late for us. They've kind of been overtaken." And we see them overtaken by whatever radioactive material that is now, you know, it's coming out of there. He waits till the last minute until the radioactive cloud is just at the door, and he slams it, closes it, and then a few minutes later, his wife shows up, and she's on the other side of the glass, and very, very dramatic moment. They see each other at the window, and she's saying, "Take care of our son," and then another door closes, cutting them off. We cut to the son at school, and we see from his point of view, as he's looking kind of very Three Mile Island-ish, right? Those towers that are very indicative of nuclear reactors, they're collapsing, all of them. And it looks amazing because it looks very realistic. So now we cut to 15 years later, so we're in present day, and we meet their son, who's now grown up. His name is Ford Brody, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. And we're in San Francisco, and he's just come off of a 14-month deployment as an EOD bomb disposal specialist with, I believe, the Marines. Might be with the Navy, not sure. And he meets his wife, Elle, played by Elizabeth Olsen. You know, they're doing a little character development here. He comes home, like they're kissing. They're playing with, you know, he sees his son, so on and so forth. And finally, they're alone, and they're kissing each other and about to, you know, rock and roll. And a call comes in that his father's been arrested in Japan, so he's got to go and bail him out. So there's this moment where he was caught trespassing in the quarantine zone. Joe says, "I'll be back in 48 hours. And Elle says, "Don't worry, it's not the end of the world," which I think is kind of, you know, funny, as it kind of will be, in a way, very soon. So now we cut to Tokyo. We're at Joe's house. We're with Cranston again. And man, it's a great art direction here because this is the home of a conspiracy theorist. You know, you go in his home and there's shit hanging everywhere. It's a mess. He's like, "Don't touch anything." There are all these charts. And, you know, he's been, for years, he's basically been obsessed with what caused the destruction of the plant because he thinks it's something really weird and special and that it's been covered up and people, they know what it is, but they won't let anyone in on it. So he's like this crazy conspiracy theorist. And he got caught in the old quarantine zone of the town they used to live in, which has been shut down, as was the plant. And he thinks it's all kind of BS, they're hiding something. not a great relationship between the two of them. We get a sense that this is not the first time that Joe's been in trouble. The Ford's had to bail him out. But Cranston's amazing. We get more of the story of the frequency that Joe tracked the night of the accident and how it's now cropping up again. And that whatever it is now growing in strength. And that Joe has discovered this. You know, that night, after a little bit of drama, you know, Ford goes with his father, sneaks into their old house. They take a boat into the quarantine zone, and it's beautifully shot. Like, there's a volcano in the background, and they enter this sort of 15-year quarantine zone, which is mostly flooded. Very post-apocalyptic. It's all CGI, but man, it's beautifully done. Looks like that city Pripyat, which is now like the setting for every, you know, other thriller where, you know, the bad guys meet and exchange plans, right? The abandoned city in Russia because of Chernobyl. So they're in this zone, and Joe has brought a radiation detector, and it reads zero. So they take off their hazmat suit helmets, and they realize that that was the first lie. So they go back to their house. Joe finds his old discs. From that vantage point in the house, they can see that the nuclear plant is very much alive. It's like a hive of activity, which is very strange because supposedly it was closed. And then when they come out of the house, they're arrested and taken to the plant. And there's some weird sort of glowing structure in the middle of everything, emitting the very same radiation curve. And we see this out in the main control room because now we've seen this curve several times and we recognize it. We see Sarazawa is there with his colleague. They send him to talk to Brody, but he remains outside the interrogation room, sees the discs that were left outside, and pulls this up, this old printout of the shape of the seismic waves, which he realizes now that, you know, Joe was right all along. Now we're seeing that as the thing's growing stronger, it's sort of draining the nuclear fuel from all the reactors, feeding on it in a way. They attempt to kill what's inside because they realize now that it's growing so strong that it may actually let go. And it's in this sort of pit that's covered by these metal cables, supposedly containing it. And so they shock it with these massive electrical arcs, but it only winds up opening the cocoon, freeing this thing. And it emits this powerful EMP, shuts the whole place down. And wonderful shots of this creature as it emerges. We don't get much. You know, we do get definitely a good chunk of it, but not long shots. It's beautifully designed. It's got this really cool kind of triangular head, and it's on these big gangly arms. I mean, it looks like a big praying mantis. It's very cool looking. And we see Joe. Now there's a very poignant shot of Joe watching the creature because this is the creature that supposedly killed his wife. And then we see it attempt to break out of the cables that's keeping it cocooned in there. So it does finally pull them down, and there's a lot of mayhem and a lot of destruction. And Joe is sort of pulled down into it, and we think he's dead. The U.S. military arrives soon after it escapes because the creature does get out and fly away. Actually, we realize that it can fly. The military grabs Sarazawa and his partner. He points to Ford. He's like, we need him as well, ostensibly to help him understand his father's data or what his father was working on. But Joe, then we realize that Joe is not quite dead yet. He's on the chopper with them. He's on a gurney. Ford's right next to him, and he dies right in front of him. So the death of Cranston, which will be quite lamented as this film goes on, because he was a great presence in this film. And I think it would have been that much better of a film if he was all the way through, but not to be. So now quickly, we're on the USS Saratoga carrier, and we meet Rear Admiral William Stenz, played by the ever-reliable David Strathairn. And we're introduced to the term MUTO, which is short for Massive Unknown Terrestrial Organism, which is kind of a cool term, the MUTO. The confirmation is that it can fly. The American military is very aware of it. We get confirmation that as part of its defense mechanism, it can emit an EMP pulse. Now we cut to Hawaii. And we start our first what I call Nolan-esque mini-movies in this film, because I think Edwards learned from several directors when he made this film. I think what he learned from Nolan is to have mini-movies in your movie. This is the first one. So this mini-movie is Ford on a subway. He's trying to get to an airport to fly home. And a little boy is separated from his parents at a stop, and now Ford, of course, takes charge of this boy. So, you know, this first mini-movie is, you know, will Ford get the child back to his parents? It's his sort of emotional, you know, quest during the attack, and something supposedly human that, you know, we can latch onto as the, you know, the first monster battle happens as it's coming up. We're with the Special Forces team in Hawaii, and they find this Russian sub up in a set of trees, which is very cool. Russian nuclear sub. It's a great shot. Again, it's at night, so they light the Russian sub up. Edwards does this several times in the film where he lights things up at night, and you realize the full extent or size of something. It's just very good directing. Very cool. From, you know, a camera on the helicopter, we see the flying MUTO gulping down, you know, nuclear waste that was in this sub. Then we cut quickly back to the carrier, and they've gotten signals of a new bogey coming in, and I will end there. The tone of this remake, very much like the original, but with updated acting, you know, very, very good acting so far, and the cinematography and the direction is just the best of the three. I mean, Edwards is clearly, obviously, had, you know, all of the Godzilla films to learn from, and another 10, 15 years of film history other than Emmerich, but it's very well done, and it has more of an international thriller feeling, as well as Edwards' classical widescreen shots. Like it's beautifully done, and you can just tell there's a real depth touch at the helm. All right, so I will stop there with three intros. So now we're going to talk about the backstories of the three Godzillas and compare them. So in the 1954 film, we have this local legend about a monster who invades the island of Otho and eats people. They sacrifice, you know, young women, of course, to him to appease the monster. The paleontologist Yamade theorizes that atomic testing took this sleeping organism, woke it up, and dosed it with massive radiation because, you know, and now it breathes fire. And they don't say explicitly that it affected his size, but only that it made him more powerful. But we can assume the same. It's not necessarily that it created this thing, that it kind of existed already before, but that atomic testing did quite a number on it and made it, you know, much more powerful and much more frightening thing, which is kind of interesting to think about it. You know, that they're saying that it's not evil incarnate, but it was certainly, the ante was certainly upped by nuclear testing. The 1998 Roland Emmerich film, straight out nuclear testing, created a hybrid animal, and they set it up with the Chernobyl worms. So it's a very brief and to the point backstory. In 2014, it's kind of a little more Byzantine. We hear the story that the first nuclear sub, the USS Nautilus, dove for the first time, that it awakened something drawn by the radiation, presumably Godzilla, and that at that point, then they tried to kill it with bombs. I guess we get the sense that, you know, the fire and all of its abilities were already intact, not that they were created by the atomic tests. They don't say that anyway. What we hear is that Godzilla is an alpha predator from an earlier age, when the Earth was more radioactive than today. When the Earth changed, these kind of creatures sank to lower depths, supposedly absorbing radiation from the Earth's core. So then after the 60s bombings, this Monarch Group was formed, a multinational secret organization dedicated to finding it. The skeleton that we see is of a different Muto, and the two spores that it contained obviously are the two Mutos that come after. The three backstories to Godzilla. So now I want to move on to comparing the very first reveals of Godzilla and how each film does it. In 1954, it's very brief. When we left our villagers, they're ascending up the hill, and we get the shot of this bulbous-looking head and neck, and then we hear the roar. We hear the booming sounds that we heard earlier in the film, and we can't tell if they're footprints or soundtrack cues, but so we see that briefly, and then a bit later, we see from the hill's vantage point, you know, Godzilla has vanished, these giant footprints with the tail in the middle heading out to sea. The reveal is pretty cool. He's, you know, all we see is the head and neck, and we see how the scale of things, how big he is. And it's pretty effective, I guess, for its time. It's not classically cinematic, but it's a decent, you know, reveal, and that you don't get the whole monster. In 1998, Emmerich's version, the reveal comes, you know, it's raining out. This old man goes out to the end of a pier with a fishing pole, right? And of course, we know what happens next. He throws a pole in, and there's this giant swell of water. And we see two fins, which is actually, you know, from the massive plates on Godzilla's back. Fisherman runs away. And now, you know, the first event really is Godzilla being seen in part by others. We just see giant legs. We see spikes on his back. And we see his tail disappearing around buildings. And then we see his jaws as he crunches a truck. We have a little bit, another steal from Jurassic Park, right? Mayor Ebert is giving an address. And suddenly the entire area moves as if it's an earthquake. The cars jump up. Everything, you know, move. The car alarms go on. And it's basically Godzilla's footfalls are causing everything to jump. And this is right out of the Jurassic Park playbook. You know, when the T-Rex is coming, they see the puddle. Have the ripples in the water and the puddle. So same deal, just escalated for the size. Then we see an entire building collapse and more spikes and then legs chasing people. And then we're in the newsroom and, you know, the bad boss is speaking directly towards the camera and behind him, the head moves past the windows. And of course, the woman he's talking to sees it. And so we get to see that head. And then we see legs and feet. Audrey's outside with Victor, the cameraman. And we just see a tail disappear. And Victor's right underneath it. So we see the huge foot. That's, you know, he barely survives being crushed by it. Like, he's in between the toes when it stamps. But still no full reveal. And then it's off. And then, so Emmerich's definitely playing by the less is more playbook. We've only seen a head, legs, tail, never the whole monster. And it's good suspense. You know, we've seen enough of it. Like, we see the head. And the CGI is okay. It's not the best. Definitely now, when you watch it, it's dated, you know, and it's definitely a CGI Godzilla. To me, like a CGI monster, it's going to rise and fall with the fortunes of the rest of the film. I think we have a really good film. You know, people hack on the CGI zombies of I Am Legend, and I don't. I think it's a really good film, so I don't mind the CGI zombies. You know, I'm not going to be that disingenuous and be like, oh, the zombies were CGI, you could tell. The movie stunk. Like, it's a really terrific movie with good performances. And yeah, you have the CGI zombies, but you know what? The movie's good, and I don't mind. The Godzilla in this film will, you know, he'll rise and fall with how good the movie is. And when the movie gets dumb, as it does later on, then it's just like a big CGI puppet on the screen. And you don't really care. Anyway, so now on to the 2014 event. We start with this luau on the beach in Hawaii. It's nighttime. And we're cutting back to Ford on a train with this kid. And then we cut to the Muto and it triggers an EMP and the whole city goes dark. This chopper that was about to blow it up completely crashes because it lost power. And then we get our first inkling that Godzilla's in the area, that the tide goes out. And they're doing the whole monsoon playbook here. Since 9/11, right, and since the monsoon, like, people know how to do destruction in cities now with all the dust and the debris better than ever before because of the 9/11 footage. And this is another reason, like, they can do tsunami stuff now great because we have the tsunami footage. It's a little weird to think that, you know, we're mining our national horror to make our films look more realistic, but, you know, that's what we do, like it or no. Of course, you know, we're focusing on a little girl, and the tension's great. We see the back spikes in the water, and then it ducks under the aircraft carrier. So Godzilla really never challenges the military. They're always kind of shooting at him and making a hash of things, but he never directly goes after the military. Like, he's after the Muto. So now we're in kind of a disaster movie flick. We have the tsunami engulfing the city, you know, the wall of water, people running, really well shot. And then we have this wonderful reveal of Godzilla, and it's just beautiful. You know, the water, you see the water coming into the city because it's after the EMP, it comes back up on generator, but then the water from the Godzilla's passage has shorted everything out. So it's completely dark. And we see three soldiers on top of a building shoot off flares. And the camera follows the flares up in the air. And then as they descend, they illuminate the bottom half of Godzilla. And, like, it is the coolest reveal I've ever seen. I mean, the massiveness of Godzilla in that moment. Like, his up to his thighs is, like, above the tallest buildings there. Like, it's so cool. And it's in the dark. And, you know, when the flares go out, we don't see it anymore. So it's unbelievable. So now the lights come back on in the city, and the Muto now appears near, of course, when Ford is on the train, right? The train lights light it up, and we're getting shots of the Muto from the train, like handheld, as it were. The train passes right under it. There's a lot of save the kid tension here, which is just, I don't know, it's kind of bullshit. But they need to Ford needs to have a little movie to do something, right? Then this is an amazing sequence of shots when they're at the airport. The Muto damages the helicopter, and it spirals into the airport, setting off this chain reaction as several fuel jetliners explode. And it's like in sequence, and the camera follows it as if you were watching it from inside a terminal. And it's beautiful, really beautiful. And then from stage right comes the massive legs of Godzilla, and we get the first full body reveal as the camera pans up, and then one of his full-on roars, which is just amazing. Then we cut away to Elle Brody's place in San Francisco, and it's funny kind of seeing her son is watching the news while she's in the kitchen, and he's watching the full-on battle, which is being filmed by some news copter somewhere. And she's like, turn off the TV, honey. And she's like, and he's like, Mom, dinosaurs. And then she finally comes around, and we get her jaw drop, and then we're out. Those are the first reveals, and obviously, you can probably hear it in my voice, I think the 2014 film is mastery. I think it is You know, he's pulling on all the Godzilla films and all the other films that have ever come before, right? And he's just nailing it. The flare reveal to me is just the coolest thing I've ever seen. And it's beautifully done, so I really think it's great. So now I want to take a pause and talk a little bit about, now that Godzilla has been revealed, what he looks like in each film. The 1954 film, I want to go back to a little bit of how Godzilla was conceived. The film's special effects director, this guy called Tsuburaya, his original suggestion of the monster was a giant octopus. And then the design went to several variations, and such as a hideous, disproportionate ape-like creature with a head shaped like a mushroom. So the mushroom head is kind of the mushroom cloud, right, that he's an atomic creature of some kind. But in the end, they basically settled on a dinosaur-like monster that was a cross of a T-Rex, an iguanodon, and a stag. And, of course, the fire-breathing dragon. The Godzilla suit for the 1954 film was a last-minute thing. The effects director was really impressed with stop-motion animation used in King Kong, 1933, and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which came out, I think, the year before, sort of the Harryhausen stuff. And they wanted to go that way. For the money they had, it was way too much money and too time-consuming, and they needed to get this film on quickly. The man-in-a-suit Godzilla was born. And the scale model of Tokyo, obviously. But it proved very difficult. The first attempt at the suit was far too stiff and heavy and hot, and they finally hit on a design that worked. But the stuntmen would suffer from like numerous bouts of heat exhaustion and dehydration being in that suit and doing shot after shot. It turned out that you can only wear the Godzilla suit for 3 minutes to do three-minute shots. At one point, one of the effects guys inside of it passed out due to heat exhaustion, so you can imagine. And he looks kind of like, you know, his head, he does, kind of like a deformed mushroom. Godzilla's head is really weird in the man in suit Godzilla's. It's kind of like this deformed mushroom, totally. And he's got this classic bottom-heavy bulge, like, you know, fat Godzilla. His legs and his lower body are very beefy. Like, he's not lean. The Emmerich went a different way, but the original Godzilla, as conceived, was this kind of, you know, very beefy lower half and kind of goofy-looking head. But it's very strange. It's a very strange-looking animal. And so Emmerich in 1998, they went for, like, iguana mixed with T-Rex. And he's much more sleek, and they went with Jurassic Park's horizontal running dinosaurs, which was the, you know, once Spielberg put it on the screen, like, that was it. T-Rex is now, you know, they are horizontal standing. It's funny, the head and the mouth of the Emmerich Godzilla reminds me of this DC villain, supervillain, Doomsday. It's really like encrusted with armor, you know, the massive plates on his back. I mean, they're really heavily pronounced ridges on his upper back. It's like, to me, it's like Doomsday crossed with a T-Rex. And he looks badass. Like, you know, CGI being what it is, like, he's a badass looking creature. The legs are kind of goofy. They're kind of like mannish legs and arms a little bit, but the face and jaws are really cool. And the ridges on his back are really neat. So I don't know. I know people like to hack on the Emmerich film, but it wasn't, other than what will come as to be terrible acting and writing. And that was pretty cool. And in 2014, of course, he's so beefy in this one. And to me, it's like a cross between a bear and the original man in suit Godzilla, like, because he's really beefy. But when he roars and when his head, it just reminds me all the time of a bear's roar, you know. And I wouldn't be surprised if bear roars were even part of the roar, which, you know, the guys who made up the Godzilla roar are very secretive about what they did, and I'll get to that in a second. But, you know, there's the wonderful armor on him, and when he roars, his upper neck and his head shake with the effort. So he's totally CGI, but he's really cool. He really, because of the way Edwards shoots him, he's totally believable, because you're not getting, you know, you don't see him completely for very long. And I think that's the smart thing, because you get a CGI Godzilla looking the way this Godzilla does, you know, after a while, you're just going to start noticing the flaws. And so Edwards is very smart. I'm going to go into the roar a little bit, only because it's very interesting how in 1954 Godzilla, the original roar, they tried using animal sounds very unsuccessfully. So the music composer came up with using a double bass, a leather glove with pine tar resin that was dried on it. And they would rub the glove with the pine tar resin up and down the strings and then, you know, obviously put effects on it as well. And it's so cool. I mean, there's nothing else in the world like the original 1954 Godzilla roar. It is amazing. And to me, it's still the best roar of all three films. I don't think the two remakes get the roar well. They do other things to try to make it a little deeper and a little more animalistic, and I think it just loses the distinctiveness of it. But that original roar is something. Emmerich's 1998 film. The roar sounds more like animal roars, less, you know, definitely, I don't hear the original roar. I hear it a little bit buried in there, but it's much more like a bunch of different animals blended together, and I don't think it's that great. And the 2014 film, same thing. Like, I don't think it's that good either. The guys behind it talk about how they recorded sounds that were pitched in a hypersonic, so, you know, outside the range of the human ear, and they used a computer to pitch them down. Okay, you know, that's cool, but it's not a great roar. Like, I don't hear any of the original Godzilla roar in it at all. It's still, it's much more like a big animal roar. The face, though, I mean, during the roar, the face is just like, it's the most dangerous thing you've ever seen in your life. Like, it's definitely, and again, the bear thing, I have to believe that the bear head, and if you look at a bear roar on YouTube and then you go check out Godzilla's roar of the 2014 film, I am sorry, but, you know, they're pretty close. So now the fire breathing for each one. So in 1954, right, you had the really cool, and it was definitely, you can see a photographic effect, the back of the spikes on a spike glow when he shoots fire. And it's a very cool detail. Like, I don't know who thought of that, but I really like it. And the breath itself is not fiery, right? It's not like a dragon's breath. They call it his atomic breath, and it's kind of like this misty type of thing coming out. And of course, black and white, you don't know what color it is, but when it hits most surfaces, they instantly ignite. So it's not like he's a flamethrower. Whatever's coming out is this superheated breath that ignites any building on contact. In the 1998 Godzilla, it's more like a dragon. Inside of the mouth, you get this glow, but it's straight fire that comes out. Like, he is a dragon, basically. They went, and it's kind of cool. Like, you know, it's not bad, right? It is what it is. There's not too much fire breathing, but it's kind of cool when it happens. And the 2014 film, and they do a great thing where the first time Godzilla uses the flame, again, you're in the dark of San Francisco, and the tail lights up, but they follow it. The tail lights up from the tip, and it slowly, you know, in succession, it glows from the tip all the way up the spine. And then so the camera follows it and then rests when it's there on Godzilla's face, and then he has the huge fire thing. And it's very much like the original film, but it's like a cold blue gas flame is all I can say. It's very, very powerful, and it seems to affect the Mutos pretty badly. Like, when they get a full head of this stuff, they go down. But the tail glow lead up and how it works is just, it's so sharp. I mean, it's so cool. And it's a wonderful homage to the original film that they kept, that the spine lights up. I thought, I mean, if you're a Godzilla fan, man, and even if you hate this film, that was pretty damn cool. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the what I call the film story's poster reveal. Basically, the rest of each film. Just go through them briefly. The original 1954 film. So after the Godzilla reveal, you know, now everyone knows that Godzilla is here and in the neighborhood. So they send out this anti-Godzilla frigate fleet. So you get some kind of stock shots of, you know, naval ships throwing out depth charges and they're exploding, right? And then you get a little bit of a plot. There's a reporter who wants to interview the mysterious Sarazawa. And Emiko knows him, obviously. It's her fiancé. So she brings the reporter to interview Sarazawa, but he will not disclose what his research is. So the reporter leaves, but she sticks around. He shows her what it is, and it's kind of a goofy scene because he drops a little pellet in a fish tank, and then all of a sudden, Emiko screams, and we cut away. So that night, the first land attack, and it starts with Godzilla rising in the bay, and it's at night, so you don't see a lot of Godzilla. You just kind of, his presence is there. You see a military attack briefly to obviously no effect, and then you cut to the full evacuation of the city. You know, pretty realistic, right? Smokes and sirens and, you know, people running in the street. And then you have Godzilla approach the set of power lines. It was a really cool effect for its time. You know, he's shrouded most of the time, so you can't really see him too well. But you see this presence, which is really cool. And we get a train running on an elevated track, runs right into him. And we see the shot of him with a train car in his mouth, and he kind of tosses it away. It's a little bit of a goofy shot. It's a very cool, the night shots. Honda was very smart about not revealing too much of Godzilla, you know, because it was a guy in a suit, so you kind of had to hide the flaws, you know. But it makes it a more imposing and more artistic approach because Godzilla is mostly this ghostly, you know, massive as he is, he's mostly an unseen ghostly figure in this film, which is kind of cool, which definitely Edwards cribbed from big time. Also the train, too. There's the initial Godzilla shot. And Edwards' remake, the 2014 remake, and with the train. So, you know, definitely pulling from the original film, so he must have studied the hell out of it. So then he heads back out to sea. That's his brief little, you know, shore attack. And then there's the basic, the story goes that they're, you know, they put their heads together and they're going to build this huge network of electrified fences to protect, the, you know, them from anything coming out of the sea. And it seems like they're going up really fast. It's kind of a, one of the problems with this film is the editing. You don't know really how much time passes ever, frankly. All of a sudden, you know, they're built. And then we get a little bit of the story. There's a rift. Hideto wants to tell, you know, Emiko's father about, like, they're going to get married and not Serizawa. But they get into this big argument about Godzilla. Yamane doesn't want to kill him, wants to study him. And Hideto is, like, opposite. So we get the classic, you know, the father's like, leave this house and never return. So there's a rift, you know, a little bit of the love story here. Then we get the full-on destruction of Tokyo. Again, it's at night. Godzilla comes into contact with the powered fence now, this huge thing, but it's completely ineffectual. We see the atomic breath now and full bore as it melts the tower. And then he just heads into Tokyo and starts torching the place. And we see that his back, like the plates on his spine, glow when he emits the atomic breath. And he's mostly shadowed up top. Like, you know, you're seeing him, you must have seen the lights of the city and this massive figure. And you don't see with a lot of clarity his upper parts, which I think is very cool. There's another cool shot in this sequence where from a long distance you see Tokyo as like a line of fires burning straight through the city, Godzilla kind of in the distance behind it. It's very cool, silhouetted. Another really cool shot in this part where the camera's shooting from a low angle directly up at a building, and then kind of Godzilla moves out of the cover of that building and we see his upper half and his head. It's really cool. You know, Honda definitely had an idea. I think he's a terrible editor, but I think he had an idea of how to make this more of an artistic thing than just a goofy guy in a suit, and you can see it. At this point, the jets come, the Air Force, and this is really goofy city. The jets look like, when they shoot their rockets, it looked like somebody lit off a firecracker. It's very fake. Godzilla's kind of flailing around, but the jets kind of, you know, run him off, and he heads back into the sea. And then there's this aftermath of all this, where all of a sudden you're back in like a real movie again. There's this powerful soundtrack, kind of dirge-like music playing, very somber, and we see a montage of hospitals and babies crying and, you know, Honda trying to give us a sense of, you know, there was real destruction here and not just a fun guy stomping over Tokyo. You know, like it, the one thing about, I think, Honda's first movie, the first Godzilla movie, is that there is a through line of somberness here. I'm talking about the atomic tests creating Godzilla, you know, that he's unstoppable, so on and forth. You know, underneath this goofy, poorly edited movie, like, there are elements there, you know, which I'll get to in the end. So then we get this plot about the oxygen destroyer, right? So the story goes something like this. Emiko betrays the scientist, Serizawa, so she tells her boyfriend about this oxygen destroyer. Then we figure out what it is. You know, he created this thing that destroys all the oxygen in the water. And we see the flashback then of the scene where he drops the pellet in the fish tank and she screams. What happens is basically the device destroys all the oxygen in the water, killing everything. But then we also see all of the fish in the tank all of a sudden just skeletons. So somehow it's dissolved their flesh too. So that's, I guess, why she screamed. So there's this whole thing that he will not let this device into anyone else's hands because it could potentially destroy all marine life in the world and hence destroy the, you know, human race. There's, you know, he's very tortured about it. They confront him and they say, listen, you know, he's going to come back and destroy the city. You have to use it. So he decides to use it, destroys all his notes. He goes underwater with Hideto in these old-fashioned big helmet diving bell kind of things, which is kind of cool. They plant the device. Hideto returns, but Serizawa kills himself. He waits till kind of Godzilla is right there and then hits the device and then cuts his airline. And Godzilla looks like he's having a bad time of it, actually. He tells over the radio Serizawa before he kills himself to Hideto and Eniko, please be happy, and then he's done. And then we see Godzilla in his death throes. He kind of collapses underground amidst the sea of bubbles. And then there's a quick shot back to his skeleton. So supposedly the thing destroyed his flesh. We get this line that's probably the funniest line in all of moviedom, right? Godzilla will never rise from the ocean's depths again. Ha ha. Although the old paleontologist is hinting that perhaps Godzilla was not the only surviving member of his species, and if the human race continues nuclear testing, another one may appear. And then the film ends very, you know, on a very down note. It's not a triumphant ending. You know, sunset shot, very dark. Like, you know, this may be the first. Now, Emmerich's film, the 1988 remake, after Godzilla's first reveal, we now cut to New Jersey, and we're at a military staging area with all of our principals. And Audrey steals a press badge and puts her own picture in it and tries to find Nick. And we see this shot of a hole in the Met Life building, which I find really improbable, but, you know, very cool. You know, as Godzilla had, I guess, smashed through the Met Life building, but it was still standing. Kind of weird. And then we get our first visit. The French Secret Service, led by Jean Reno's character, Roche, are in a UPS truck, and they've got all the surveillance equipment. And there's a running joke in this film, which I really like, about the terrible coffee and lack of, you know, croissants in America. So one of Roche's buddies comes in the truck, and it's raining, and Roche opens the box, and he's like, "No croissant?" And he's looking at this donut as he'd be like, "What is it?" And then he sips the coffee, and he's just like, "Oh, you call this coffee?" So there's a through line in here, which you have to take what you can get in this movie, basically. So now the plot moves forward, and Nick Tatopoulos basically says, "Why do we have to chase Godzilla? Let's lure him out." So the military takes his advice, and they pile up this huge bunch of fish in the middle of the city, waiting for Godzilla. Then we get our second in-joke with the French, where Roche sips the coffee again, and he's like, "Oh!" And Roche is like, "You said this was French roast!" And the guy throws his hands up in the air, which, I don't know, I find it very funny. And there's a good tension-building sequence now. It's raining out, it's night, the fish is out, everyone's waiting, the lights are on. You know, we see smoke coming out of the manhole cover, and finally Godzilla just, the street starts to split in a very Spielbergian fashion. And then we get the huge head erupting from the ground, followed by the body, and we get our first full-on look at the CGI Godzilla. And then there's a long battle between the army and Godzilla. So basically our principals get out of the way, so the army opens up with helicopters. It's pretty cool, you know, opening, they take shots at Godzilla, and he's constantly ducking and moving out of the way, so the military is destroying the city, not really Godzilla. So in this instant, he ducks, they destroy the Flatiron building down to 23rd Street. The army gives chase. Godzilla turns around. Now we see the breath for the first time, which is pretty cool. No atomic breath here. Straight up dragon breath, right? Just fire. And this chase through the city is a very clever idea because, you know, he has places to hide always. He's just out of visual range, dodging around buildings. They continue to miss and take out. They took out the Chrysler building. And then they talk about, which is kind of a neat idea, the fact that Godzilla is cold-blooded and heat-seeking missiles do not work, that he's colder than the buildings around him, which is kind of cool. And he's also too fast for regular targeting, which again, you know, as bad as this movie is, one of the writers in this fucking screenplay thought this shit through, because you get stuff like this that's coming up in the middle of nowhere. At the same time, you get this abysmal acting and dumb characters. But they thought it through, you know, it's not the most best executed film. There's a through line here that if it was done by someone else might have been interesting. Then there's a cool moment where, you know, Godzilla is actually very smart. He creates a hole in a building and all the helicopters kind of stand there looking for him, and then he crashes through the building behind them and knocks them all down. And then at the end of this battle, he's won. We see him kind of jump onto a building in full dramatic view, and then the lightning flashes. It's very old school cinema, but it's cool. And then we pan out. So then Audrey bumps into Nick, sees him buying pregnancy tests in a pharmacy. Again, another cool idea. And then back in the lab, some of the specimens that he took from where Godzilla has been, he used a pregnancy test, finds out that actually Godzilla is a she, and she's pregnant. You know, again, part of this is, too, the writers want to use this as, like, you know, I think even Nick says it, like, well, salmon, you know, go up the show. Other animals go back to their lairs to spawn, you know, of why Godzilla would travel to New York, but I ain't buying it. I give them points for at least addressing that why the hell would this animal come halfway around the world to New York City, right? They're just addressing it, but it's still absurd and they never solve it. At one point, Audrey's left alone in the lab and she sees the military cassette that has the footage of all the stuff that had happened up until now, and she steals it and leaves. So then, a little bit later on, we see Nick in a military briefing, and he's pushing the idea that there are eggs that they have to find. And the military is very much like, there's no eggs. We have to kill the big monster, and that's it. He theorizes that all the fish, there was no fish left at the end of that big battle. And Nick theorizes that it was for the young, which, again, it's clever. They're trying to lay out a plausible scenario, right? But, of course, during the briefing, a new show comes up with footage of the tape, and they all think that Nick leaked it, and he's kicked off the project. So they have a falling out. He's picked up in a cab, but it's Roche driving. Takes him to some undisclosed location. And they're going in to find the nest because they believe him. And so, you know, Nick's going to go with them. The cameraman, Victor, had followed them and lets Audrey know that they're all going in. And if she wants in, you know, Victor's going to follow them and tape it all to kind of exonerate Nick and his theories. And of course, you know, she does. So this is another funny moment where, you know, the French are going to masquerade as American soldiers to get into the city. And they all have chewing gum. And Nick's like, what's with the chewing gum? He's like, makes us look more American. And they pan to all the guys in the truck. And it does, like, it's hysterical, man. Like, there was some, you know, the French getting back in America, I think, because the French get bashed by the U.S. all the time in pop culture. I think this is like a little bit of really funny revenge of poking fun at some Americanisms and our terrible coffee. I loved it. I loved it. The plot, the army now decides they want to put a shitload of fish in Central Park, lure him back out again, while the rest of our team heads into the subways. And there's one moment where Godzilla, on his way up to the surface, bursts right in front of the French and Nick. It's basically just a scare moment. Nothing happens. Godzilla leaves, you know. Then we get a cool camera shot of directly above the city, and we see Godzilla kind of going through the city on the main streets, which is kind of neat. And it's a cool shot as he emerges right into Central Park momentarily. Very cool. But he doesn't take the bait, heads back into the city, and they wind up chasing him into a river, and there's this long sequence where it's Godzilla versus submarines, which is just boring. He makes them miss, they destroy each other, but the whole sequence here is not filmed very well, and it looks fake. And there's sort of a false ending. You know, the military thinks that they've destroyed Godzilla, so we're done for now with the big guy. Back in the city, there's a funny little Easter egg as some guys are robbing a store. An audio video store. We see the movie Beast from 20,000 Fathoms on one of the TVs as we pan by quickly. So a little Easter egg to, you know, the movie that kind of spawned all these. May have been the first kaiju movie, frankly, but actually King Kong probably came first. But funny little Easter egg. The story ends kind of the French and Nick find the nest at Madison Square Garden. They find the eggs. And my whole theory here is that this is Jurassic Park. Emmerich and whoever's writing team were like, hey, we can do Godzilla, but we can also do Jurassic Park. Let's get into the babies, which are the same size as raptors. You know, right at this point, there's no more big story. Godzilla is ostensibly dead. But you have human-sized Godzilla hatchlings now. And it's, if you remember the scene in Jurassic Park near the end where they're chasing the kids through the kitchen and through the lodge, it's just a rip all over again. And there's some cool scenes here. They find the eggs, and they hit the lights of the garden, and they see hundreds of them. Like, so hundreds of them about to hatch. Very solid tension. Nick gets close to one, and it actually hatches. So the French set up all the C4 to blow the place, but the babies are coming out willy-nilly, so they're all hatching. And then, you know, the next couple of sequences are all about, it's, you know, they're not Spielberg, so it's kind of boring. It seems to me that they're way too close to the protagonists that they don't actually kill them. You know, like our protagonists are always just ahead of the animals and they seem pretty slow and pretty stupid. One clever idea, this is Audrey's, you know, shining moment, is that this, I guess, is a direct feed from Madison Square Garden to news stations for, you know, sports games. And since they have, there's no power in the city, they have no way to call the military to tell them to, you know, bomb MSG. So Audrey actually goes live from Madison Square Garden, has her moment. One of the guys at the station is listening and puts her on the air. So she has her moment and the military does listen because they show footage inside MSG of all the eggs. Very clever. Again, you know, underneath this really dumb movie is actually a very clever story now and again. So now the next thing is destroy Madison Square Garden, and there's, you know, well, still chasing with the little Godzillas. It's boring and dated. Finally, the military gets in. Our heroes barely miss being destroyed as Madison Square Garden is blown apart. And then there's a coda here. The main Godzilla was not killed, now emerges from beneath Madison Square Garden, sees this young exterminated, and then there's this whole dumb sequence where Godzilla is chasing our protagonists in a cab. It just goes on for too long, and it's too dumb. It's part of the Emmerich tone of this film that's just stupid. It goes on for way too long. So they take Godzilla over, I think, the Brooklyn Bridge, and he gets caught in the wires, which is kind of cool, and he's kind of stuck there because he can't get out, and the jets come in and finish him off, and he's actually dead. That's done. And then our little coda is that there's one egg left in the rubble of Madison Square Garden, and right before we fade out, we see a crack in it, and we go out. So then the 2014 film, I'll finish that off. We had the Hawaiian emergence of Godzilla. We see the city afterwards is destroyed. Our character Ford returns his Asian child to his parents, so that part of his little story is over. And then we get this great top-down look as a chunk of the U.S. Navy fleet, the Saratoga, and, you know, our admiral is following Godzilla as he swims towards the Mutos in the States. Now we're talking about the second spore, which it turns out they dissected the second spore. They thought it was inert. They transported it to a nuclear waste dump in Nevada, which probably was the dumbest thing you could do. So they suppose it's the other one. The answer to the first Muto's call is somewhere in Nevada. So we cut right to Nevada, not wasting a moment of time. The military is on the way to the waste dump at Yucca Mountain, which I guess is a real nuclear waste site. And they do this great thing where, you know, they're looking in all of the nuclear waste bays, right? And these little windows where they can look in and see the waste. And the one that the Muto's supposed to be in, when the guy pulls the window, he's blinded with light. And so they open it and we see that that whole chamber is empty. And whatever was in it tunneled out. And then we follow it. And then in the distance, we see way far that it's heading towards Las Vegas. Very cool. And when it goes through Vegas, we see that this Muto is way larger than the first one. Cannot fly, but the head configuration is the same. And we get from the scientists at some point that this is the female. The male is smaller and can fly, and this is the female Muto. Then we see a massive swath of Vegas taken out as it continues to move towards San Francisco. This new plan, which is our next mini movie, they're going to lure both Mutos out past this coast in at San Francisco, kind of put all the warheads way out far, a couple of miles out to sea, and when the Mutos descend on the nukes, detonate them and kill them both. Clever enough story, right? You got to have something. It's got to be some kind of story because, you know, people are kind of useless in these big movies. So you got to give them something to do. So there it is. So now, because our hero Ford has to be involved in all this, the staging area for the nuke train is in this place called Lone Pine, California, and Ford is there. And because he's an EOD bomb specialist, that, you know, he's the best man for the job, so he's on the train with them. He makes a phone call to L, and we're getting set up for the, like, I'm coming to get you, you know, which is so stupid. L sends her baby out with a friend, and she, like, stays in San Francisco because the writers were like, oh, he has to have a reason to go there. And meanwhile, he doesn't even run into her until it's all over. It's ridiculous, actually. But anyway, we're very much missing Bryan Cranston at this moment. I feel like Bryan Cranston could have taken both of the Mutos with his stare alone. We get these great altitude shots of the monster's path and lots of clogged freeways, giving you a sense of kind of the scope of the disaster, which really looks good. And then we get this night sequence of the train, which is really cool. The train is stopped because they have to go through this tunnel to go over a bridge, and they send soldiers to check it out. But then, you know, we see just over the next rise that there's this battle, and, you know, we get a sense that they're fighting one of the Mutos that's coming for the missiles. It's great. It's pitch black. Soldiers are out on the underneath the bridge checking it, make sure it's safe. And we get out of the Spielberg world, War of the Worlds playbook. These two soldiers are walking near the river, and this flaming tank comes out of nowhere. And before we don't realize it, and it floats by on the river, and then the camera pans back, and we see all this kind of burning military wreckage, which, right out of the Spielberg playbook. And it looks cool. Like, it's really neat. And now fog rolls in, and it's very cool. Lots of tension, because now with all this fog, you can have the monster very close and not even know it's there. You know, usually at this point in these kaiju movies, they start to drag, the second act starts to drag, but because Edwards and his team took a page from Nolan and The Dark Knight to have these mini movies inside their big movie, like, nothing ever really lags. I mean, not that it's the greatest story ever, but, like, there's always some new mission or some new task that's coming up, and it moves you through that second act, you know, which is kind of cool. I mean, I think you sacrifice depth of film when you do that, but for a monster movie, you know, there's no real depth anyway, so it was a very smart story choice. There's this great night sequence where the Muto is crawling in and around on the bridge, and it's coming in and out of the fog. It's beautiful. And at one point, Ford looks up, and we see this glowing egg sac underneath. So, you know, they're doing the Emmerich thing where, you know, Godzilla has children. The train basically runs off the bridge, and the Muto eats the missiles, so the whole train thing was just a waste. I think it might only have eaten one of them. And I don't know. What's great about the scene is it's mostly quiet in the night. It's mostly this dead quiet fog, and then the monsters moving in and out. I don't know. Really beautiful scene. Just pretty to look at. So Ford is rescued. There's a whole tension set up with, you know, Elle and the child. I'm going to wait for you, baby. You know, snore. There was a single missile left by the Muto, so that's the one they're going to try to bring out to still lure the two together. They're going to put it on a boat with plans to take it offshore. That's sort of the next, you know, little mission. And then there's this whole scene on the Golden Gate Bridge. It's raining, full of cars. The traffic's backed up. We have Ford and Elle's baby boy on the train with the woman who took her. you know, on a school bus because, you know, we got to have our protagonists in harm's way. But first, we see this massive bird migration, which I think is amazing. You know, like they're fleeing something. And then you see Godzilla arrive in the water, so you can only see his back. And then he goes under the bridge. And isn't he was about to leave the whole area, but the military start firing on him. And at that point, he stands up and starts kicking ass. But you don't really see a full-on shot of him still. It's all pieces, which is great. And then one of the Mutos kind of triggers its EMP, and the whole city of San Francisco goes power down. So it's dark and foggy in there, which, you know, very smart, Mr. Edwards. At this point, once the EMP is triggered, like we're right with L as she's walking around. All of a sudden, she looks up, and this guy is descending from a parachute out of the fog. And then out of nowhere, his jet, which had lost power, flat spins into a building. It's just, it's a crazily cool shot. Like, you just don't see it coming anywhere, you know. It's so unexpected. You see all these jets sort of crashing into the bay and crashing into buildings that they all lost power when the Muto triggered its TMP. It's just the shot of the parachute and then the plane, his plane hitting. I don't know, man. It was just a stroke of genius in this movie where there are so many great shots. So then our next mini movie, right? For whatever reason, the last missile that we're trying to head out because of the EMP, the train stopped. So the Muto took the missile and it's in the middle of the city. So, but it's this clockwork timer, right? So they set a timer to blow the thing. And because of the EMP stuff, it had to be a clockwork timer. So it's still active. So the next little movie is they have to go and disarm it. They get a halo jump directly on top of the location, disarm it. Now, this is kind of near the end game. Elle's running around the city, stupidly looking for, you know, her boyfriend. Or husband, I should say. And then we get this rising of Godzilla here as he faces the Mutos. It's so beautiful, man, when he steps up. And then the next shot is this jump. And again, it's so many cool shots in this remake. The army crew with Ford, of course, now Ford's a paratrooper, who knew? They're all in this cargo ship, and they're going to just drop straight in. And they're going to do what they call a halo jump, which in military terms means high altitude, low opening, which means you jump and you don't open, you shoot till you're very, very close to the ground. I think in reality they use altimeters because to make the timing perfect. We follow them. They all jump out of this plane and they have these red smoke canisters taped to their ankles. And Edward steals the Giorgi Ligeti's music from 2001, the monolith music with the crazy voices during the jump. So you don't hear a lot of ambient sounds. They're jumping, and there's this red spiral, and you hear that music. It's beautiful. And then the killer shot comes from the camera's way far away, and you're seeing the dark city, and then all of these jumpers sort of appear at the very top of the clouds and, like, light up the city with their flares. It's a beautiful shot, man. It's almost Miltonian, you know? It's like they're in pandemonium now with the devil. Reminded me very much of the beginning of The Two Towers when Gandalf and the Balrog are battling as they plummet towards the, you know, middle of the earth. At one point when they fall, they crest this large cavern and the camera pulls way back and you see the glow of the cavern and you start to discern the size of the cavern by the glow of them descending into it. But their size is so small, like, it's beautiful, and Edwards just stole it and stole well, I might add. And so these scenes are intercut with scenes where from the point of view of the jumper, so you're looking through goggles, like there are goggles over the camera. And this made me think of very much the when they find the monolith in 2001 on the moon, the one part of the movie that does Steadicam, like there's a Steadicam shot of the astronauts going down into that little depression where the monolith is. I think he got that from this. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think he's all over the Kubrickian scale of this film. And I don't know. It's brilliant. So then the halo jumpers have landed, and we get this another amazing moment as Godzilla emerges from the mist and gives us this major roar, like, incredible. And the larger Muto is right there, having just laid its, you know, spore eggs. It moves to intercept. So then they're starting to battle. We don't get a lot of their battle until the end. Edwards really keeps the main monster's battles to the very end, which I think is so smart, because it's too much, and you'll get tired of it too quickly. You know, see Pacific Rim for the way it should not be done. So we're still with the military, and we get into the spore hatchery. It's very alien-like. It made me think of when they find the eggs in Alien. And we see the warhead is already juicing this massive clutch of spores, and we can see, like, dozens of mini Mutos already alive inside, growing. And then we cut to the two Mutos battling Godzilla. You know, it's all in kind of a little bit of slow motion because they're so bloody big. You know, at the first moment we see them, no one has the upper hand. So then we cut back to Ford and his crew. They can't disarm the bomb because the clockwork has been damaged, so they have to get it to the boat. And then we see Godzilla going down under the two Mutos. He's basically losing. Once the military leaves, Ford pops the gas caps on this huge, you know, gas tanker, blows it up, completely destroys the spore nest, which distracts the Mutos from finishing off Godzilla. They both run back to see, you know, about their babies, which is kind of cool that, like, in that moment, you know, a human being did something that affected the outcome of this Muto-on-Muto smackdown, as it were. And I thought it was very plausible. Then there's this amazing shot, this huge Muto. Ford's the only one left in the area, and it's about to kill him because it sees him. And then all of a sudden, we see this bluish glow appear directly behind it. And the camera follows the glow as it spirals up. And we come to see that it's like, it's Godzilla's tail that's in pre-atomic breath light-up mode. And it's just crazy how cool it's shot. Because Godzilla was in darkness up until that point, hiding kind of behind the Muto, snuck up behind it. But the glow of the tail lights the thing up. And then we know what's coming next, and his atomic breath blasts the hell out of the Muto, the male Muto, I think. And then the female Muto senses the nuke and goes for it. Out to sea, and then Godzilla dispatches the male Muto with his tail. It was great. It's a great shot because the Muto's coming towards him. It's been bugging the shit out of him because it grabs onto him and then flies away, and Godzilla can't get at it. So it's flying towards him, and then the camera flips back to Godzilla's face like, this time, buddy, you're mine. And then he ducks, and his tail comes around and just smashes it into a building, and the camera falls to town, and it's dead. And it's so cool. I mean, that's the kind of scene is why you go to a Godzilla movie, right there. That's the scene, you know? It's just so cool. Anyone who naysays this movie about the battles, I don't know what they're talking about, because, I mean, that is the shit right there. Then we still get shots of L running around the city, and Ford, where are you? Just so stupid. But the final battle, and even better, the final battle between the female Muto and Godzilla has the ending of all endings. You know, there's this moment where it's about to sort of get Ford's on the boat, heading out to sea with the nuke, and the Muto's about to kill him and eat the, you know, the nuke. Godzilla grabs it, pulls it back, right, and then wrestles it to the ground, pulls open its jaws, and atomic breaths it inside. It kills it. And it disintegrates to the point where when Godzilla stands up, he still has the head in his hands, and he kind of drops it. And then he roars like, I'm the king of the bloody universe. Like, it's the coolest thing I've seen in a film in decades. Like, it's amazing. Just amazing. And then there's our last little coda, as if you needed one. You know, Ford's on this boat heading out to sea. The clockwork's still timing down, but the helicopter gets him, and it blows up out to sea, which I'm sure, if there's a sequel, that is going to have something to do with drawing out, like, all the Mutos in the area. But that's just my speculation. Then there's this kind of false ending. Godzilla has collapsed with the effort, and, you know, day comes up, and his kind of spine is buried in the rubble. But, you know, he wakes up, heads out to sea, and, you know, he's hailed as a liberator. So very different from the ending of the first film, and obviously the second. But the first film really was a darker ending about the dangers of nuclear, you know, and this unstoppable force. But since then, in all the decades past, Godzilla has become the hero of most Godzilla movies, and he's defending the Earth from other monsters, and Edwards goes there with this, which is great. I mean, what a way to combine, what a way to try to really please everybody, right? Making the film dark to a certain extent cinematically, and then, you know, keeping the fans kind of happy by, like, no, Godzilla's kind of the hero of his movie, you know, when he heads back out to sea. So briefly, I kind of want to compare the actual human beings in these films and then kind of do a final summing up. I will let you all get back to your lives as I'm clocking in at over an hour at least to get this point. You know, the characters in Godzilla films mostly suck. It's mostly a joke, right? The original film had, you know, Hideto, a salvage ship captain, and Emiko, the daughter of a famous paleontologist. Basically, you know, it's this love triangle. She's supposed to marry Serizawa, the dark, brooding scientist, but she's in love with Hideto, and they want to tell her father. But it's boring, you know, and the acting in this film is terrible. Pretty much everyone is pretty horrible. She's the worst. You know, when she screams, it's like out of the worst B-movie you've ever seen. And the love triangle is clever, you know, in a sense of the story that she has to betray. I hate the anti-feminism of it, like, you know, the woman's only role in this is to betray the man, you know, and to so on and so forth. Whatever, it's 1954, right? The paleontologist guy is kind of cool. He's kind of goofy, but, like, he has some gravitas to him. He kind of reminded me of the Cranston character a little bit in the remake, wants to study Godzilla and not kill him. He's kind of a brooder. And then there's Serizawa, the tortured scientist. Was okay. As a character, it's kind of cool. Has this technology, doesn't want to use it. The scar causing him to wear the patch he got in World War II. But it's terrible acting overall. You know, none of these characters, the paleontologist to some degree, but for the most part, the rest of them are completely disposable. So in Emmerich's 1998 remake, I mean, this is the weak point of this movie. Broderick is fine. Roche is funny. You know, you have the Siskel and Ebert mayor. You have Hank Azaria as the goofy, funny cameraman. The character of Audrey is just so unlikable, mostly because of the actress, I think, than anything else. But, like, the problem with this film, with the characters, is that he moves into what would become very much like the Transformers model. You know, like, the coolest special effects on the planet with the most offensive acting and dialogue you have ever heard in your life, right? And unfortunately, Emmerich's Godzilla is basically a comedy shot through with some suspense. It's like two screenplays. It's like there was a real screenplay in here that tried to do this for real, and then someone slapped on this really dumb comedy on top of it and ruined it, basically. And you know what? Broderick's likable. Like maybe there was a shot at the comedy angle. And Jean Reno as Roche is great with the coffee and all this French stuff. And Vicki Lewis is good, but the Siskel and Ebert mayor and, you know, the head military guy and Audrey's whole story, it's so stupid. I mean, in the taxi cab chase and that kind of stuff, and it's bad. It's really bad. And so most of the characters in the Emmerichs are just really awful. To be honest, the Edwards remake is not that much better. The best characters in his were in the beginning, Juliette Binoche and Bryan Cranston. They were terrific. You know, it was like starting out Superman with Marlon Brando, right? They started out Godzilla with these great actors, but they're gone right away, you know? And then we're left with Ford Brody and his wife, Elle, the two most milquetoast, boring characters you could ever have. And Brody's useless, you know? Like, he doesn't know much about the monster. You know, his EOD knowledge, I guess, is something in the film, but at least the character of Totopolis in Emmerich's film came up with the food lure plan and kind of knew what created the monster, you know? But Ford's just a grunt, and he's boring. He's just eye candy, you know? I wish they would have found a way to keep Cranston in the film. You have his son get killed, but Cranston survives. It's like he's seen too much horror or something. And then you have Ken Watanabe as Serizawa, basically. That's his character's name. David Strathairn, and they're given really bad lines. Every line that they utter is some goofy, doomy, "He will rise again. He is the Alpha Predator." And all these horrible lines. So there's no real jazz either way there. Briefly, to compare the films, I mean, you can't compare the original to anything, so I'm not going to do that. But the original film set a tone. They did a bunch of things that I think the remakes capitalized on. So they set up a tone of humans in a human story and Godzilla versus the military, which has been like the template. Honda also did most of the Godzilla scenes at night, making them much more believable and a little more arty. You know, when you see the sequels, not the ones I'm covering here, but the actual Godzilla Man in the Suit sequels, two dozen of them. When you see most of them, Godzilla Man in the Suit fighting the monsters in broad daylight, it looks stupid as can be. And I apologize to people who love those movies for what they are. But you're talking cinematic technique, it's terrible, you know. So Honda was the only one who realized you got to keep the monster in darkness and you got to use really dramatic lighting and rain and all other stuff to keep it, you know, partially hidden. So it's the menace, not so much that you're seeing every last inch of the thing. He pioneered that, and I think the two remakes went with that as well. And there's also a serious through line here. At the end of the movie, it's a very down ending because it's like, you know, if we continue on with the atomic testing, more of these suckers are going to come out of the woodwork. So, you know, most of the acting is bad, but I mean, Honda did okay in setting up certain things that other people would take, you know, so it's a kind of a landmark in that way. And as far as the remakes go, Emmerich's film is weird. There's a spine of the story, if you can swallow the journey to New York, that is, that makes sense, that was thought through. You know, that he's attacking fishing boats, the egg laying, the cinematic device of Godzilla hiding in a city was very cool rather than just stampeding it. Really sets up to me Edwards' film because it's a great idea. The pop tone of it is completely wrong. It makes it really stupid. But, you know, this is before blockbusters got what I call Nolanized, when everything got very serious. And the CGI is a product of its time, say what you will. You know, it looks the way it looks. For Edwards' movie, I mean, again, he's had the benefit of 5 decades of Godzilla movies, but it's the most beautifully shot kaiju movie I've ever seen. I mean, what it is it's more of an accumulation of beautifully shot scenes than an actual film. But The truth is, I think that's the best you can do with a kaiju film. Like, what, you know, these aren't real movies, because the fact of the giant monsters having to be a part of the movie, you can't really write a real movie around them. And, you know, I think Edwards came as close as you can come, but he recognized, you know what, let me just string a whole bunch of really great scenes together. And then, whatever, some stupid story will pull it all together. I mean, in a way, it would be great to pull out the underlying military story and just have this be like an art movie where you don't know anything, but you just see all these wonderful, cool scenes. Like, I think that would be the subversive, amazing Godzilla movie, which no one would ever make because this is the real world and I'm crazy. So to me, this is, you know, I love this movie because this is a guy who has a real eye for scenes and cinematic techniques and direction. He's got flair. His shots are all different types of shots. They're all well thought out and really cool to look at. Real cinematic technique here, which brings together the lessons of, you know, all the other Godzilla movies to date. And he takes them all in and he does something, you know, and masters it to my mind. And I think him and Emmerich are very smart to use the city to obscure the monsters. Honda did it a little bit too, but a lot of Honda is Godzilla is just so bloody tall that you always see him. So I think that's going to conclude my comparison of 1954 Godzilla, 1998 Godzilla, and 2014 Godzilla. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com. And you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen. And that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page. And on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.